ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Afternoon. Now, they're terms that you've heard a lot by now. Net zero, carbon neutral, sustainable. What does it actually mean for agriculture, and how are farmers and our key industries planning to achieve these lofty goals? It's something we'll be taking a look at over the course of The Country Hour today. Selena Green with you bringing you the program. That includes a new sustainability council that's been put together for the grains industry.
This has got to be industry-led. Like, we can't let government do this or anyone else do this. This is our industry. It's about leadership. It's about stepping up to the plate and saying, right, we need to own this and move this forward, rather than the other way around, because I know it won't pass the pub test if you let government do this and then we've got to do something that government has done. Just won't pass that pub test with growers.
You'll hear more from the South Australian farmer who's part of this very soon. Also, why has there been such a delay in compensation for those impacted by the 2011 live export ban to Indonesia? More on that to come as well. If you'd like to join me today, my talkback number 1300 222 891, or the text line is 0467 922 891. Well, first today, dairy farmers shouldn't be getting their hopes up for a higher milk price next season. That's according to at least one analyst. While reduced import costs are giving some confidence to dairy farmers ahead of the milk price being set on June 1, seasonal conditions are an unknown factor for the industry. Rabobank senior analyst Michael Harvey told Fiona Broom there's also some uncertainty in the domestic and global dairy markets.
At the moment, there's a couple of things everyone's focusing on. One, the weather and what the next couple of weeks hold in terms of autumn break and how that'll go setting up the season. And generally, you know, people are reasonably positive around what that might look like for seasonal conditions, because clearly that goes a long way to setting up the season for profitability. But there is clearly a lot of interest around what's going to happen with new season pricing when we get to that deadline around June 1. So, you know, we're looking at the markets and we'll certainly provide some commentary around what we think the new season milk price will look like in the coming weeks, but we're certainly still looking at the underlying drivers of the milk price and seeing positive signs continue to emerge. So it's a good setting. You know, confidence levels are up, things are pretty good on farm, there's some confidence that we'll see another good milk price next year, but there is that conversation around will it go higher, will it go lower, but what does that mean for the business and profitability for the new season?
And looking ahead to the new season milk price, which we're expecting by the 1st of June, any tips, insights on what you think the price might be there?
Yeah, so we'll come up with a formal view leading up to June 1. I mean, the messaging we've got right now is, one, I mean, there is still a lot of uncertainty around what's going on in global markets, but also in the domestic market, and that's part of the conversation I'm having with our clients here is around the commodity markets coming out of a significant downturn. We didn't see a lot of pressure on the farm gate price through that downturn, which is a good thing. But we want to see the commodity basket continuing to improve, so we talk about the fundamentals that sit behind that. But we also know that the domestic market in Australia has been doing a lot of the heavy lifting around performance, because unfortunately for consumers, they are paying a lot more for their dairy products, but that's providing a better return for our domestic market moving forward. But everything we're looking at from a consumer point of view is that we're seeing trading down in food purchases. And dairy's not immune to that. So there is a bit of margin pressure coming back down the value chain, because consumers are looking for cheaper alternatives or actually purchasing a little bit less dairy. So that you've got to feed that into the equation. And the other one is always currency, because we do export some commodities. You know, we've got an Aussie dollar that we think will appreciate over the next 12 months, so that's got to be taken into consideration. But you bundle all that together right now, and our view here is that it's not going to likely go higher in southern Australia. There could be some downward pressure, but it's going to be a minimal correction in milk price. So when you look at the long-term trend here, we've had a couple of years of elevated milk pricing. We think that'll be the case moving forward. So we've got really good signals for stability in that milk price, which is what we've been waiting for.
The milk pool has been reducing year on year over the past few years. A lot of that now going towards domestic consumption. How's the export market looking?
Yeah, look, the drop in milk supply has been problematic for the supply chain, and that's what you see going on post-farmgate around, you know, asset utilisation adjustments and, you know, just rejigging the supply chain to the new reality around what that milk pool looks like. There is some positive signs coming through around milk production is starting to stabilise and grow again in most regions in Australia. The processors are probably not wanting to see it too strong at the moment because they're locked into paying milk prices at the current levels, but then selling into a market that's still a little bit sluggish. But I think it's still good news to see that milk pool stabilising. And it comes down to the fact that there's been good profitability across most parts of the industry. The price signals are there. Better seasonal conditions, so that's part of the story. But you know, the challenge at the moment is, you know, exports have been pretty sluggish. The export sector has been under pressure, one because there's been soft demand in some export markets, but also it's been very hard to compete in some of those export markets with the spread between our milk price versus some of our competitors. And then, you know, the thing we've been talking about a lot is also that import threat that's been building more recently, which is just part of the landscape, right? We do import a lot of dairy products into the domestic market. They have jumped up more recently because we've had less milk, but those cheaper imports do put some downward pressure on returns in some of those domestic markets. So that's all part of the conversation.
That is Rabobank Senior Analyst Michael Harvey, and he was speaking there to Fiona Broom. 11 minutes past 12. Well, back in 2020, the cattle industry successfully won a class action in the federal court, which ruled that the Labor government's live export ban to Indonesia back in 2011 was unlawful. It's been almost 4 years since that ruling, and more than 200 claimants still haven't seen any compensation. The process looks set to be delayed even further. That's according to outgoing president of the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association, David Connolly.
Well, our lawyers contacted me yesterday and said that the government solicitor's office has requested an extension of time before they get back to the class action with regards to some crucial information, and they required an extension, and the further extension would take their time that they're allowed to get back to that action. It'll push it out a further 9 months, or it would push it out to a total of 9 months. And I mean, our lawyers got the information that the judge required within 2 months, and they're just a, you know, small office in Canberra. Why can't the government solicitor's office, with all the power and money and people and all the resources they've got, why can't they do it in 2 months? Why do they need 9 months? Well, I'll tell you why they need 9 months, is they don't want to finish this action. They want to keep kicking this tin down the road.
You met face-to-face with Murray Watt just the other week. Do you feel like any of the NTCA's concerns are cutting through?
Well, what I did find out was that Murray Watt doesn't have the carriage of this action. It is with the, you know, it's with the Solicitor General's office, or the Attorney General's office, sorry. Mm. But in reality, it's with Caucus, and we know that. It sits with, you know, Albanese and his team around the table. They'll be talking about it. And my concern is, and I express this to Murray Watt, is that he's a fella that's going to be left holding the can on this. He's the agriculture minister. This is being done on his watch, and when things aren't happening, he's the fella that's going to hold the can on it. He's the bloke that's going to be left with you know, the dirt on his shoes from it. And his colleagues are allowing Murray to end up with the, you know, with the dirt on his shoes from it as well. They're going to hang him out to dry. You watch.
That's the thoughts of David Connolly. He is the now former president of the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association, and he was speaking there to Matt Brand. 13 minutes past 12.
Do you often feel overwhelmed by the daily news cycle? Too many headlines with too little context? Well, join me, Sam Hawley, for ABC News Daily.
You know, there's middlemen involved, and you have to make sure that the farmers are getting a good deal.
A podcast that walks you through one story per episode to help you with a deeper understanding of the issues affecting your world, all delivered in a comprehensive yet easy to digest 15 minutes. So join me for ABC News Daily.
Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
It was Selena Green on the Country Hour today. Well, industrial hemp harvest is underway, and some growers are trialling some new equipment this time around. Brought over from America, new fibre cut technology was trialled in the southeast, making the hard task of harvesting the fibre, well, a bit easier. Peter Rigetti is from South Fibre Australia, and he says harvest yields so far have been looking positive.
So we've been fortunate to be working with some local stakeholders down in the Coonawarra area for a couple of years now. I work with the Moulton brothers. And so this year we've had some really good growing results. We tried some new techniques and some new genetics, and we've had the pleasure of trialling some new equipment that we've brought out to the United States, some cutter technology.
Yes, so hemp is really hard to harvest. You can't just use your normal equipment, can you?
Well, yeah, sort of yes and no. We've had reasonable success using windrowing equipment over the last few years, but the end user requirements are now looking at the fibre being cut to a certain length. So we've got to the stage in the industry where we've now got a multi-level sickle type setup. Then also changes the characteristic of the hemp when it hits the ground. And we've got a process called retting where it conditions. So we're basically cutting it into shorter billets, and then we're finding it rolls really well into round bales, and it also presses very well in square bales.
So I imagine a bit expensive to get this tech out all the way from America. The demand's there, though. There's enough industrial hemp being grown in Australia?
It's funny you should say that, because at the moment we're a net importer of industrial hemp, would you believe? There's more of it being used in bespoke housing than you would realise. So our intelligence says that we're importing somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000 tonnes at the moment. And it's coming from mainly from France, Belgium and the Netherlands. So we're setting up in one of two locations to immediately attack that market. And to that end, we're hoping to receive some support from the South Australian government and also our local government area to get a plant in South Australia up and running immediately.
And that would help encourage farmers to give the crop a try?
Yeah, it would. So establishing in a local area close to the grower base means they can bring it to our receiving point economically, and then we can process it, condense it, and then from there it can be shipped to major markets on the eastern seaboard. Likewise, too, we've got strong interest for the bast fibre. It'll go overseas and get blended there and come back like a lot of things do. But it's a very strong market for that. So that's where we're at. So we are looking to upsize our operations in South Australia.
Has the South Australian government been receptive to your suggestions?
Look, we've got strong interest from the New South Wales government. They're interested in new industry there. The South Australian government, we're in discussions with them, and we hope to receive their support.
And harvest underway now. How were some of the results in Coonawarra?
Yeah, really good, Elsie. We've seen between 10 and 12 tonnes per hectare. Really good, healthy plants. It was a good growing year. We didn't need to irrigate too much at all this year. But in any case, even in a dry year, it is a relatively efficient plant to grow.
So results are still improving year on year mostly?
Yes. So that's a good question. So what we're doing, and this is the experience I found in Canada and the United States, old knowledge they know from Eastern Europe, where it's hemp production has been unabated for the last several decades, but we find that specific varieties can perform to a higher level in certain areas. So we in South Australia, we think we've come down to one or two varieties which are particularly suited for our latitude and our growing conditions. Then as you look up and down the eastern seaboard, you get different results there, and we look to different varieties for those areas.
As the co-founding director of South Fibre Australia, Peter Righetti there, speaking with Elsie Adamo.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Right now it's 18 minutes past 12. What does sustainability actually mean, and what does it look like for the Australian grain industry? It's a big question, and one a newly formed Grain Sustainability Council will tackle. Industry reps from across the nation gathered in Canberra last week for a Grain Growers Grain Sustainability Forum, where they got an update on what's happening with the Grain Sustainability Framework. I will get that word out. It includes the formation of this new council, which is made up of members of both Grain Growers and Grain Producers Australia. And Grain Producers Australia Sustainability spokesperson and York Peninsula farmer Mark Schilling explained its role.
The Grain Sustainable Framework has been put together by GGL and GPA to actually, you know, one, bring our groups a little bit closer together, like growers have been asking for the last couple of years, and let's, you know, take a whole industry approach to this in the grains group so that, you know, farmers have got something tangible that they can use in that sustainability framework. Now, it was a great day that, you know, we got together, looked at what has been and where we're going. And so now there's been a council set up, which is, you know, two from each group. Richard Norton, Nigel Corrige, Brennan Taylor and myself, and then each of the CEOs, Colin and Shiona. You know, we're going to sit around the table and, you know, come up with the framework and basically get a working group so that we can actually bang out some matrices or some pillars that growers can actually utilise, rather than, you know, we can be talking about this. And let's be honest, this has been going on for 4 years. Not necessarily are growers are going to get rewarded for it, but it's actually going to be a basic requirement moving forward, is to have some proven credentials, might I add. Like, these have got to be proven credentials to have market access into some of our markets, which are demanding it.
And this isn't just, this is domestic and international markets that this is becoming an increasing demand?
Oh, absolutely. Like, you know, probably more international. But, you know, everyone wants to prove these things out, whether it's the Slavery Act or, you know, whether it's, are we using electricity? Are we solar panels? You know, everyone's wanting this. Nobody can give you definitive answers. And I think one of the things we've got to be careful of is we don't greenwash or sustainable wash. Because this is what we've seen in the past, is that there's some greenwashing happening in this carbon area. So we actually have to be the leaders here and bring something to growers that they can actually put their hands on and trust it and build it. And I see it as a bit of a management tool also for growers, so they can use that to help manage their business and benchmark against other businesses and to other businesses around the world.
Because I imagine that is a very tricky thing, because you see the word sustainable, you hear it a lot, but how hard is it to pin down what does sustainable grain production actually look like?
Well, you think about it. Intuitively, growers have been doing this for 30, 40 years. Somebody's now put a name on it, right? And so, you know, this is the challenge now, is sustainability means different things to different people. And we have to come up with that framework, or, you know, is it the guide? You know, sustainability guide for growers. Now, whether they implement or not, that's entirely their choice. But, you know, we've been called by the industry that something needs to be done. So, yeah, that's what this day was about, was to bring everyone together. You know, we had 100 people in the supply chain, which all contributed, and we listened, and now we're, yeah, going to hit the task, because the other thing we brought in is an independent chairman, Tess. She was part of the grains for meat and livestock, so she's had a bit to do with sustainability, so she gets it, and she can help guide us through that network.
And obviously important to be industry-led, and as you said, whether growers will already doing some of these things or follow along with it, a lot of that will be market demand will be driving that.
Oh, absolutely. Look, this has got to be industry-led. Like, we can't let government do this or anyone else do this. This is our industry. It's about leadership. It's about stepping up to the plate and saying, right, we need to own this and move this forward. And then, you know, help frame that for government. Then they can, you know, help develop policy around what we've done, rather than the other way around. Because I know it won't pass the pub test if you let government do this and then we've got to do something that government has done. Just won't pass that pub test with growers. The other thing is we need growers to engage in this as well. Like, if we're going to get any sort of outcome, growers have got to be, you know, engage in it and help us develop it so we get the right outcome. That's the biggest thing. It's got to be grower-focused.
That is Grain Producers Australia's sustainability spokesperson is York Peninsula farmer Mark Schilling, and the members of both grain producers and grain growers who are forming this new Grain Sustainability Council, formed in Canberra last week. Speaking of this whole issue around sustainability, the Regional Australia Institute is actually in Adelaide today. It's dropping a couple of new reports around net zero for regional Australia, what it means, but also what it means for key industries like agriculture. We'll hear a bit more about that on the program after 12:30, so stick around. That's not too far away, including from one South Australian farmer who reckons he's got there. He's got his farm carbon neutral, and you'll hear a bit more about how he's achieved that, and we'll hear from some of the speakers from this Regional Australia Institute event on the program tomorrow as well.
For all those yearnings for truly outstanding entertainment,
I have an idea of what might cheer you up.
You'll find a trove of Academy Award winning and nominated films on ABC iView.
Let's play.
Like Imitation Game.
It's beautiful.
American Sniper, Her, and Spotlight.
There's a story here, and I think it's an important story.
Brooklyn, Carol, and so many more.
Bon appétit.
Always free, always outstanding on ABC iView.
Time to head off to the Weather Bureau. Our forecaster today is Mark Analak. Hello, Mark.
Good afternoon, Selena.
Much happening exciting in the weather front?
Not really, to be honest. We've got a high pressure system south of the Bight, and it's basically near stationary, directing a cooler south-southeasterly airstream across agricultural areas and into the southern pastoral districts. One thing that this system is delivering is clear skies across much of the state. Maybe some partly cloudy skies about the southern coasts and the upper and lower southeast districts, but generally clear skies, and that resulted in a pretty cool night in some parts. Cummins was the overnight low across the state, 2.7 degrees early this morning. Clare made it down to 5, and other places around sort of that mid-north and Eyre Peninsula area did get quite cool into the sort of the mid-single figures. The good news about clear skies is we have a clear sky day, plenty of sunshine around across much of the state, and we're starting to see the temperatures rising across South Australia. Currently, down the southeast where we're sort of affected by cloud, temperatures are rising to around 17, 18 degrees, 19 degrees over the southeast corner in Kangaroo Island. Further north, where the skies are clear, temperatures are jumping up into the low to mid-20s across agricultural areas and into the high 20s and then low 30s across the pastoral district. For the rest of today, we can expect these clear skies to continue. There is a little bit of moisture feeding into the northwest, and there is just a slight risk of showers and thunderstorm about the far northwest corner of the state this afternoon. Tomorrow, the high pressure system does not move an inch, so we can expect a very similar day tomorrow. Another cool night for inland areas with clear skies. Partly cloudy conditions still persisting about southern coasts, so we could see sort of slightly milder overnight temperatures, but the day itself should be fine and very similar to today, and that moisture still poking into the far northwest corner, although we're not expecting too much in the way of rainfall tomorrow. Thursday, the high pressure system moves a little bit further east, and temperatures probably up a couple of degrees, but again, it should be a mostly dry state. And then it gets quite interesting for the Easter long weekend. There's lots of what-if scenarios that could happen. But at this stage, it looks like we'll see extensive shower and thunderstorm activity across the pastoral districts, possibly pushing into the Flinders as well through the Easter long weekend, gradually contracting eastwards, and hopefully by sort of early next week we'll see that push out to the east and we're back into a southerly flow, bringing cooler conditions for the early part of next week. In terms of rainfall amounts, not a huge amount expected. As I said, not too much over the next couple of days, maybe a couple of millimetres here and there about the southern coasts. Highly variable falls across the pastoral and Flinders district as we move into Friday, Saturday and even continue through the latter part of the weekend. Could be anything, up to 30 millimetres across the north, and depending on some thunderstorm development, we could see even more than that. So at this stage, I would suggest we watch this space, and hopefully when I speak to you again tomorrow, we'll have a bit more information, a bit more certainty about the weekend's weather. But for the short term, should be mostly dry for the next few days, and we'll watch that rainfall across the north with interest.
All right, and we'll check in tomorrow and see what the story is, maybe a little bit clearer for that long weekend. Thank you, Mark.
Cheers, will do.
Mark Analak there from the Weather Bureau. Now, looking at the forecast for the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow, for the upper western district, a sunny day with southeasterly winds, 20 to 30 k's an hour, with overnight temperatures falling between 14 and 17 degrees, daytime temperatures reaching the low 30s. For the lower western district, a sunny day with southerly winds, 15 to 20 k's an hour, becoming light before the dawn and then becoming southerlies, 15 to 20 k's an hour in the morning. Overnight temperatures in the lower western district falling to between 11 and 14 degrees. In the day, they'll reach up to around 30 degrees. It's coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Coming up in this next half an hour, well, an update on logging operations on Kangaroo Island, which have been stalled due to concerns around animal welfare and a number of images of koalas coming out of those plantations injured or dead. Well, a management plan is in place, and you'll hear more about that next.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Afternoon. Now, you may have seen previously some potentially distressing images of injured and dead koalas on Kangaroo Island, where there's an ongoing logging operation to remove plantation bluegums. Well, a new plan has just been approved that aims to better protect those koalas from harm while allowing that logging to resume. You'll hear more about that in just a moment. Also today, do you have a supermarket loyalty card? When you're scanning it at the checkout to get your reward points, have you ever wondered what happens with the information that supermarket is collecting about your buying habits?
Basically, they can use that information to set prices. Sometimes that can mean better prices for consumers, but sometimes it can also mean worse prices for consumers. But more importantly, it can also push smaller players out of the market.
Some grower groups are concerned, and consumer groups, and you'll find out why in this half an hour. But does this worry you? Does it put you off having these cards, or are you happy to hand over that information in exchange for those rewards? My talkback number is 1300 222 891. My text line is 0467 922 891. Keen to hear from you on this today. This is all after we get news headlines from Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, one person has died and two people are still missing after a fishing boat capsized near Port Lincoln. Five people were on the boat that was found upturned around 2 a.m. near Spilsby Island. A 44-year-old man and a 13-year-old boy, both from Torrens Park, were winched to safety from a nearby reef. The State Treasurer has raised concerns that the Commonwealth has drafted legislation to reform the National Disability Insurance Scheme without any input from states and territories. The proposed laws follow a long-awaited review into the NDIS, which made 26 recommendations, including creating more services outside of the scheme and having all levels of government pitch in. And Labor's lead in the Dunstan by-election has further narrowed as the pre-poll and postal vote count continues. Labor's Cressida O'Hanlon's lead over Liberal Anna Finizio is now 4.2% in two-party preferred polling. That's down from 5% before counting resumed this morning. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman, those headlines. Well, the logging of bluegum plantations on Kangaroo Island will resume, with a plan now in place to manage the koala population there. Conservationists have been calling for a halt to logging on the island after footage was released of koalas being injured or killed during harvesting. There's now an investigation, we're told, underway into whether animal welfare laws were breached. But in the meantime, the timber company AAG Investment Management has submitted a koala management plan to allow it to continue to remove those bluegums from Kangaroo Island. We're told the plan's been approved by the state government, and the Environment Minister, Susan Close, says she's met with the plantation owners to discuss the concerns. The Minister wasn't available today, but I am joined by the Conservation and Wildlife Director with the Department for Environment and Water, Lissian Lone. Good afternoon and thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Selena.
So this plan allows for logging to resume, and understand the company itself has submitted this plan?
That's correct. Yes, they've submitted the plan that the Minister's now approved, which once they get in place the new protocols that they've outlined in the plan, they'll be able to resume the timber felling.
So just run us through those protocols, or what measures does this put in place to reduce the harm to the koalas in those plantations?
Well, while the company did have some measures in place, they've definitely enhanced, have additional koala spotting requirements. So these are people that go ahead of the harvesters, spot a koala, they'll flag those trees, and then that tree and the eight trees surrounding it are left in situ to allow the koala to move on. So they've got additional spotters and also some additional strategies to manage fatigue and enhance communications with the people operating the harvesters. So they've got that in place. They've also got a requirement to report to the department within 24 hours any incidents, and also to give a monthly summary of any interactions. So if you like, near misses or how many koalas there the spotters are seeing. So we'll have a better understanding of how many koalas are there and whether there's any concerns by near misses or anything like that that we need to be monitoring. And as part of this, there will be, over the next 6 months, some quite intensive monitoring from the department. So they're required to tell us in advance where they're harvesting so that we can easily go and have a look at how that's operating. One of the other requirements is a more formal relationship between the vets and wildlife carers on Kangaroo Island, so that if there does happen to be any inadvertent injury or disturbance of a koala, then they've got some processes in place to manage that as quickly and effectively as possible. And and they've got some improved communication, and also just making sure that there's differentiated spotting strategies between those plantations that are safe to have a spotter work through, and then they've got some slightly different ways of doing it for plantations that have been structurally impacted by the fires and are therefore unsafe to have spotters walking through them, if you like. So the spotters operate sort of on the edge of where the harvesters are operating.
So with that requirement to report incidents within 24 hours, does that trigger a particular response within the department, or is that more about keeping sort of a tab on what's happening?
It's keeping a tab on what's happening, and for us just to check that any of the protocols and formal arrangements with vets and wildlife carers are operating properly, so we can check up on that. If we feel that there's a too high trend of those, then we might go and have another discussion with the company about whether there's any further things that can be done, or whether there's some breakdown in the protocols that are operating.
This logging's obviously been going on for a couple of years, and there have been concerns raised for some time about injured koalas coming out of the logging area. Why has it taken up until this point for these protocols to be put in place?
So previously there was no legal mechanism under the Act to be able to put protocols in place. I think the disturbing footage and the community reaction, the government felt that there needed to be something. So this management plan is approved under some brand new regulations that were only put in place a couple of weeks ago. So these new regulations allow the minister to declare an activity and a particular location, so in this case Kangaroo Island, under those regulations, and then that requires the production and approval of a management plan, whereas previously there was no mechanism under the legislation for that.
Yeah. Understood. We've been told that there is investigations underway, whether or not there have been any breaches of animal welfare laws. Is that an investigation that the department is running?
So the department's running an investigation and looking at whether there's any potential breaches under the National Parks and Wildlife Act and the Animal Welfare Act, but also the RSPCA, who provides the lead compliance, if you like, under the Animal Welfare Act for the state, is also investigating in terms of the animal, whether there's any potential animal welfare breaches.
What about when the logging is finished? Obviously, this is a process underway. Is there an overall plan for what happens to Kangaroo Island's koalas? Obviously, they've been introduced to the island, but is there a plan for managing their population and numbers going forward?
So that's another piece of work that the department's doing. So we're working in collaboration with the Landscape Board to develop a plan over the next few months, and we'll be looking to work with key stakeholders on that. So there's a number of things that have changed, if you like. We've had the 1920 significant bushfires. We've also got the plantations, a lot of which are being removed, which do provide habitat at the moment for a large number of koalas. So there are some changes happening on the island, which mean that we do need to look at that overall management and, what are the implications of the removal of some of these plantations, and what are the options in terms of management of the population if that's required.
Lizzie Alone, thanks for joining us on the Country Hour today.
Thank you.
Lizzie Alone is the Conservation and Wildlife Director with the Department for Environment and Water. So that plan now approved by the state government, it means that that logging activity can resume on Kangaroo Island. But there are some additional requirements in place now for that to continue, and that includes additional koala spotting requirements, as you've heard there, and a requirement to report incidents within 24 hours. And the department saying that it will monitor that will include unannounced site visits by staff to ensure those procedures are being adhered to. It is 21 minutes to one.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, a lot of industries are looking at how they're going to fit into the federal government's plan for Australia to be carbon neutral by 2050. And today, the Regional Australia Institute is meeting in Adelaide, where it's releasing two reports into what this net zero transition means for regional Australia, particularly for communities that rely on small or single industries. The research also looks at regional industries that are most affected by decarbonisation, such as transport, mining and agriculture. Eugene Boisvert spoke with the Institute's Chief Executive, Kim Horton.
We're looking at how the transition to net zero emissions will play out across regional Australia. We're trying to find out what sort of lessons we can learn from places that have done it well, what sort of lessons can we learn overseas, and what sort of guidance can we come up with for governments, but also for local communities in managing this transition well.
So how hard do you think it's going to be?
There's a lot of opportunity, I think, at the moment. There's some resistance. A lot of our regional places have grown up around particular, generally sort of resource endowments that they have, whether it's agricultural land or mining or even sort of views and sort of tourist destinations. So sometimes these transitions are seen to be challenging those foundations. But I think what we're seeing, particularly across regional South Australia, there's a new wave of investors that are circling around a lot of different parts of regional South Australia looking to invest in, you know, small, medium and large renewable energy projects effectively. And that's bringing the potential of another round of investment to places that haven't seen it very much in the past. I mean, you know, in the eastern states, a lot of our investment in regions has, again, been around mining or around agriculture, particularly intensive agriculture. That hasn't played out so much in South Australia. So this is really, I think, putting a lot of regional South Australia in the spotlight as a place where investment is potentially coming. So places are looking at what's the legacy of that going to be for us. I think one of the pivotal things for the Institute and all this is we need to have communities actually need to have confidence that there'll be a really positive legacy out of this next wave of energy investment across regional places.
And farms, especially, they use lots of different little machinery or, you know, tractors or things that don't even go on roads that use diesel. I think in your report it says like there are options or that they probably will do something once it's worth it. Do you think that is definitely the case?
There's a lot of work going on in agriculture, both at the state level, the national level and at the individual farm scale. Our research is telling us that one of the things that farmers like is a bit of independence and again, is a bit of certainty. So some of the farmers who've been very quick to adopt some of this renewable technology have done so because, like the Katanning community, they wanted to stop paying for electricity, which they felt was unreliable or overpriced, and they had the opportunity to invest on their own supply and storage systems, which would take them out of that sort of up and down or that sort of unreliability cycle. So that's a big incentive, I think, that idea to be more in control of your electricity supply. Farms are difficult. I mean, there's some analysis in our decarbonising report which talks about the different modes of fossil fuel use in farms. Like some of it's quite periodic. You know, you'll get a peak time in terms of harvest time. It's hard. You know, if we electrify all those harvesting machines, then there'll be challenges around maintaining the charge at peak times. So the capacity would need to be high to cope with a single peak spike across the year, for instance. So there are certainly changes. It also, you know, it does require people to think a little bit differently about how they currently use the current sort of fuel types that are available to them and how that might need to change if those fuels are no longer available. And the other thing for the farm sector too, of course, is they can offset a lot of their own CO2 emissions through CO2 sequestration on farms. So there's a lot of work going on around farms to reduce their impact and reduce those net CO2 emissions. And a lot of it's technology-based. And I think one of the challenges for Australia is a lot of those technology developments, the really big scale ones, are out of our hands. We'll be the receivers of global changes in battery technology, for instance, or global changes in small scale solar generation. We won't really be the drivers of that. And a big issue for the farm sector, I think, is transport. And clearly, it's the big truck makers and that are going to be deciding how and when that shift to electrifying road freight happens and how that shapes across Australia.
That is the Regional Australia Institute Chief Economist Kim Horton there speaking with Eugene Boisvert. Well, many in the agriculture space are already working towards net zero, both on an industry level and as individuals. One of those is grazier Todd Woodard, who farms at Rattenbully in the state's southeast. He's been working towards making his farm carbon neutral and hopes it'll be good marketing for his sheep and cattle in the future.
We believe it to be. We haven't had an external audit done on that, but my son Tom's done a carbon course, which related to pretty in-depth auditing and finding the balance sheet. And we've got a handle on how much carbon we've sequestered into the soil over the last 5 years. So it's just a matter of doing some calculations to extrapolate that out.
Why is it difficult to know whether it's carbon neutral or not?
Because, you know, under our regulations around carbon and the measuring of it, we, you know, you probably should have every area of your farm measured for carbon sequestration. So that means a T0 measurement and then a T1 5 years later to see your increase or decrease in carbon in your soil over that time. We've done it on a smaller area to start with, and now we want to really expand it over a wider area. But we believe our practices are the same within our carbon project as right across our farm. It's the same management system right across the farm. So we do believe that we are neutral, maybe positive, but, you know.
What made you want to do that? How long have you been doing it?
We really wanted to increase our carbon in our soil and just found the best way was to just really get involved with a carbon project, put some money up front and have it monitored and see our results in a industry recognised way. You know, we thought we could increase carbon and we've been really quite pleasantly surprised at the amount we've been able to increase it.
So how do you put it in the soil? How does it work and how do you work out how much you've done?
So obviously, yeah, there's all that baseline testing that has to happen. So, you know, and it's, you know, you come back to those exact spots. They're a computer-generated GPS sort of spot on your farm within your carbon area that you come back to 5 years later. So, you know, we've seen our perennial grass roots down to 900 mils in our sampling. So that's the key is to have... Well, firstly, you know, you have to have some a good climate. You need rainfall and you need clay in your soil to hold your carbon. The next most important thing is your perennial grasses, so you can obviously graze them, but they're the plants that really push their roots down, get their roots right down, create that environment for biology to live around, and as they decay and the whole process goes on, it just builds carbon through that system. And then you need a grazing system to complement that on top of your soil, so you need animals. Cows are really good in our situation, so you need bigger plants to grow bigger roots, so you need a high density grazing system that comes in and grazes paddocks for short periods of time and then puts rest back into them after that. There's other things like dung beetles and that sort of thing that always help as well, and we use biological fertilizers in the form of compost and foliar sprays, and part of the foliar sprays is a fungi called trichoderma, which is really important to digest those more lignin type materials in your grass, like your stubble part of your grass sort of things, and you know that helps break that down and drag it into the soil as well.
So is this something that customers want, or is it something you did for the environmental aspect of it, or as you mentioned, I think, you know, it's good in general for the farming practices?
I think, like, we were first driven by just increasing our own production. As this space is evolving, there's going to be opportunities, marketing opportunities. There's also a social license there as well, and I think that's where the industry needs to look at. You know, we have external expectations on us as an industry around good practices, not only animal welfare, but, you know, looking after environment and doing our thing. Animals with ruminants seem to be a reasonably easy target because you can understand and quantify their emissions. We believe the systems around these grazing animals are taking a lot of carbon back in. That side of the equation's not really looked at. So we needed some social license going forward.
Right now it's 2024, but the government's aim is by 2050 for everyone, the whole of Australia, to be carbon neutral. Do you think, I mean, that's 26 years away, do you think that can happen for everyone, you know, if you can do it now?
once again, I can't talk for other industries, let alone other farmers in my industry. But I think we can. I think our industry is imposing tighter timeframes. So, I mean, our industry's come out and said they want us to be well and truly neutral by 2030. And so that's ahead of Kyoto and Paris agreements. So I think we can. I think everyone needs to start thinking about it now, for sure.
That's Rattenbully grazier Todd Woodard there speaking with Eugene Boisvert. You can read more about this online, abc.net.au/news. And you'll hear some more on this Regional Australia Institute event on the program tomorrow. But have you ever signed up for one of those loyalty programs at the major supermarkets? Have you ever wondered what they do with all the data they collect every time you shop? Well, grower groups have called for greater scrutiny of how the big data is used by Coles and Woolies, as David Chen reports.
If you shop at one of the big two supermarkets, chances are you'll be asked this.
You have a Coles app or Flybuys card, please scan.
For millions of Australians, including mother of four, Tammy Irons, supermarket loyalty programs have helped to keep costs down.
I appreciate being able to bank that $10 each, you know, when it gets up to that level. And by the time I get to Christmas, I've got around $150 or so off my shop, which I really appreciate at Christmas time.
With about 85% of Australians belonging to at least one loyalty program, every purchase they make offers a treasure trove of data for Coles and Woolworths. Kate Bauer from the consumer group Choice says that's stifling competition.
Basically, they can use that information to set prices. Sometimes that can mean better prices for consumers, but sometimes it can also mean worse prices for consumers. But more importantly, it can also push smaller players out of the market.
Choice says the information allows the two big supermarkets to set prices that their competitors can't match and do targeted advertising to get consumers into their stores. Small business owner Damon Atkinson runs an online service selling produce direct from the farm gate just outside of Toowoomba in southern Queensland. He says the data trove gives the supermarket giants more leverage than producers.
They have a lot of leverage. We don't have that leverage they have. So, you know, sometimes we see produce on their shelf as cheap as what we can buy it for.
Farming groups from across the country say the loyalty programs are also giving Coles and Woolworths greater power over fruit and vegetable growers. They've called on a Senate inquiry into the supermarkets to investigate the impact of big data on the sector. Rachel Chambers is the CEO of Queensland Fruit and Vegetable Growers.
You've got the supermarkets with all the information on supply and all the information on demand, and the growers having no information besides their own supply and no information besides a guesstimate. Where it gets really, really unfair is the perishability of these items, which makes negotiation completely on a different playing field. So you've got growers who have already taken all the risk, they have paid all the bills to this point, now at the peril of the buyers, who now their first job is to get the item for as cheap as possible.
Producers and consumer advocates also want more regulation to better protect data from being shared with third parties. Kate Bauer from Choice again.
It's too much of an obligation on individual consumers to be able to navigate these risks on their own, just to access both basic essentials and to do their basic grocery shopping. So what we really need to happen is for the government to step in and introduce those kind of data minimisation principles.
As the political focus sharpens on Coles and Woolworths, it's a chance for shoppers like Tammy Irons to learn more about how her data is used.
I think that it's really important that we are aware of what's going on behind the scenes, and it's been good to see that they are starting to see a little bit more of accountability happening there.
In statements provided to the ABC, Woolworths says it's standard practice for businesses to look at previous sales to help predict future demand, and that it's investing millions of dollars in advertising to promote Australian produce. Coles says it uses data to inform its ordering requirements to ensure produce is available to customers at any given time and at affordable prices.
A report by David Chen. A couple of texts that have come through. One from Sean in Mangambia says, Selena, when one of the big two CEOs for the duopoly tells us their profits are only up because they are charging more, we need to question everything, including giving them more means to monitor our spending habits via loyalty schemes. He says it's a one-way street. It should be viewed with the same glasses as TikTok, says Sean. Deb's at Warradale. Her text says, hi, Selena, my privacy is more important to me than giving it away to some supermarket. Deb says she believes specials should be available to everyone, not just to those who have signed their life away. given we are in the middle of a cost of living crisis. He believes the supermarkets are being unscrupulous. Well, speaking of supermarkets, there are a number of bills before Parliament that would give greater scrutiny on these major supermarkets. The Greens have a bill which would allow the ACCC to break up major supermarkets if they thought they were being anti-competitive in the way they operate. Independents like Bob Catter and Andrew Wilkie and Nationals leader David Littleproud are also calling for more to be done. So far, the two major parties haven't said anything, and without the support of Labor or the Liberals, well, nothing will pass. But today, the Nationals leader, David Littleproud, says he has negotiated with his coalition partner and the Liberals are now on board.
Yeah, and this is what we want to do, is to get the design right, because while broadly we agree with the intent of what the Greens are doing, the Greens was economy-wide. What the Liberals and the Nationals have agreed on is that we need to focus specifically on supermarkets, because there's some nuances to that market and already architecture around grocery codes of conduct, dairy codes of conduct, horticultural codes of conduct that need to be respected and built into it, so that there is a scaling penalty base and that also you look at the arbitration that's currently missing, and as well as looking at where there's land banking. So it's a little bit more complicated than the bill that the Greens put together that we don't think would have actually addressed the issues that are specific to supermarkets, their dealings not just with farmers, but also with consumers.
So you want supermarket-specific divestiture powers, and you would support that if it respects things like the Dairy Code and the Horticulture Code?
Exactly, and that's what we want to make sure, is those industry-specific codes are respected. And what that does then mean is that they go right through the supply chain from the farm gate to the supermarket shelf. And we think that's been a missing link, and that is with the grocery code of conduct, but having those codes still run in conjunction with them, but also then scaling up with greater penalties. The penalties at the moment are insignificant, and basically they'd rob a till in Melbourne to pay for it if they were found. So what we want to see is punitive penalties that eventually, on some circumstances, would scale up to a divestiture, particularly around real estate, where most of the egregious behaviour happens. But you've got to understand, this is just a deterrent. And if the supermarkets are so worried about this, they should just sign up to it with us. They should come and help us design it. Because if they're as pure as the driven snow as what they're telling us, all they have to do is come forward and say, well, it's never going to be used. So it's okay. We're all right with that. But they've been recalcitrant on this. But we just want fair, transparent prices from the farm gate to your plate.
Was it hard to get Liberal support on this?
Oh, look, they have philosophical differences to us on a number of issues, but it's taken the leadership of Peter Dutton to work through with us that there is an appreciation that there's an issue that needs to be addressed, and that's why we're going to work together to make sure that we get the settings right without the unintended consequences, because some of the settings within the Green Bill might actually see less competition, not more. And so this is why you've got to get the architecture right in taking into account the existing framework that's there. And that's why Angus Taylor and I will be working through that to make sure we get it right without unintended consequences.
So you're prepared, you and Angus Taylor from the Liberals were prepared to work with the Greens to get a bill that you guys would see as workable?
Well, it'll be our bill because the bill that the Greens are putting up will have unintended consequences. Now, if the Greens were so inclined at the end of their inquiry to come forward with us, we'd encourage their support. But what they put forward at the moment would have unintended consequences that we are more than happy to be constructive with anybody. In fact,
if everyone has their own bill, though, is there a risk that there will be no support and nothing happens?
No, I think there is, apart from the government, there is a belief that something needs to be done, not just to protect farmers, but to protect consumers as well, where we're seeing fluctuations at the farm gate for prices, but yet that doesn't follow what happens at the checkout. And when that doesn't happen, it's important that we understand the transparency of the market all the way through. We're not asking for fixed prices, just fair prices, and that there's transparency in that. And the mechanisms that are in place at the moment haven't protected us.
That is the Nationals leader, David Littleproud, and he was speaking there to Warwick Long. Just enough time for me to tell you about a bit of breaking news. Apparently more than 100 Australian cattle have died on a live export ship to Indonesia from a mystery illness. We're being told it's likely one of the highest mortality rates ever reported on an Australian livestock shipment. The Australian Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry has confirmed to the ABC a number of cattle deaths were reported to the regulator over the weekend. A department spokesperson would not confirm the exact number, but said there is, I quote, no suggestion that any exotic animal disease is involved, such as foot and mouth disease or lumpy skin disease, but the department is investigating. Also, just enough time for me to tell you that Nikolai Bale-Hutz will be with you for the afternoon program as usual today. He'll be giving you the latest on that ongoing search for missing boaties off the coast of Port Lincoln and asking the question, were you going camping over Easter? Is camping worth all the effort or not? Should it be on our bucket list of travel here in South Australia? That's all for me. Thanks for your company today. It's just going on news time. It's 1 o'clock.
The ABC Listen app lets you take ABC Radio with you wherever you go. At home, in the gym, up a ladder, on the road,
interstate,
outer space. Download the ABC Listen app today.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.